Seeking mental health care can be overwhelming and even scary, but it doesn't have to be. I'm Dr. Josephine McNary, and I'm committed to making this process easier for you. Each week, my expert guest and I unravel a different form of therapeutic intervention in order to bring comfort and understanding and to help you get back to your true self. Hello and welcome to Mind Stories. This is Dr. Josephine McNary. My guest today is Dr. Carissa Gustafson. She's a psychologist practicing at Golden Hour Therapy, a group therapy practice in downtown Los Angeles. She specializes in acceptance and commitment therapy, known as ACT, and is the author of a recently published book, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy in 7 Weeks. So welcome to our guest today, Carissa Gustafson.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Carissa is an expert, I would say, in the use of a certain therapy modality called Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, or ACT. And she has recently written a book about it. It's called Reclaim Your Life, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy in 7 Weeks. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, I think maybe we'll just start you know so much about ACT. Mm-hmm. What is it?
Yeah.
It's kind of a broad question.
I'm going to break it down for you. So basically, it's kind of considered like the third wave of cognitive behavioral therapy. So for listeners who might not kind of know what cognitive behavioral therapy or CBT is, it's basically looking at the relationship between your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, right? And from more of a traditional CBT approach, you kind of intervene at the level of thoughts or cognitions and look at kind of what's called like unhelpful or distorted thought patterns, replace your thoughts or challenge, you know, some of the ways that you're thinking to change your emotions, and then help you to engage in more effective behaviors, right? So that's kind of the traditional CBT model. ACT, which is kind of, you know, the new CBT, goes about it a little bit differently. So instead of looking at your thoughts and looking at whether they're realistic or challenging them, looking at the evidence, those kinds of traditional CBT interventions, you're using a lot of acceptance and mindfulness-based interventions in order to, what they say, diffuse from your thoughts. And I'll kind of explain what that means too. But basically, the idea is that we can get kind of hooked into our thinking. Our people can place too much value or weight on their thoughts and not really kind of recognize them for what they are, which is really just mental events. And so ACT, which includes 6 core processes, which I can kind of break down as well, ACT uses certain processes to help people, like diffusion, which is one of the processes, to get some distance from their thinking, so that they're able to recognize that these are just thoughts, that they're not laws or rules, that I don't have to buy into them, believe them, obey them, and can help people also bring more compassion to their emotional experience, mm-hmm. Which I think can be really helpful and kind of seems to be missing from the more traditional CBT model, that being a human being is painful, that painful emotions are a part of life, that it doesn't necessarily mean that there's something wrong with me, and that I also don't need to move away from my emotions. So if fear shows up, that's not necessarily a signal that I'm in danger, right? It might be a signal actually that I'm moving towards something that's important to me, like maybe applying for jobs that are of interest or value for me. So another one of the processes that kind of comes up later, and it can come up in the beginning, right? So ACT isn't a linear therapy. All the processes kind of interact with each other, but one of them is values. So there's a big emphasis on like what's meaningful to you, what's important to you, what matters to you, what kind of life do you want to live? So when we move towards our values, like oftentimes difficult emotions show up. And so it helps people to move towards the things that matter to them, where some difficult emotions might come up as opposed to away from them.
Okay. I'm wondering if it might make the most sense, especially kind of for our listeners to really grasp what this is. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about what is the most common diagnosis that ACT is kind of the most helpful for. Yeah. I mean, it's helpful for a few different things, but I'm assuming mm-hmm. it's kind of a generalized anxiety or more of a specific anxiety. Yeah.
It's helpful for so many different things, right? So it is helpful for anxiety disorders. So it's essentially kind of like an exposure-based therapy. But it's helpful for depression, it's helpful for OCD, it's helpful even for things like psychosis. So there's a really broad application mm-hmm. of ACT therapeutically.
What do you see the most in your practice in downtown Los Angeles, which is where we are right now?
Yeah, a lot of anxiety disorders, depression, okay. and a lot of different kinds of anxiety disorders, yeah.
Okay, so maybe let's think about, I'm trying to think of kind of a sample case,
sure.
right? Or something that maybe the listeners can kind of feel connected to in terms of kind of a way that this might be of help to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So should we do kind of a generalized anxiety or more of a specific anxiety?
Yeah, well, like the things that come to mind, for example, something like social anxiety, right? So like somebody with social anxiety might have thoughts like I'm boring or I'm not interesting, I'm not funny, or maybe somebody who's depressed who thinks like, well, people don't like me, you know, I'm not a likable person. Mm-hmm. And then because of that, they might not, you know, socialize, they might be kind of withdrawn, they might be, you know, even just more depressed as a result of that. And that kind of behavior just maintains their kind of belief system. Mm-hmm. But if they're able to recognize that this is kind of like, these are mental events, these thoughts that are showing up, it's kind of something of a story or a narrative that they've developed or a way of thinking about themselves, as opposed to something that's like a fact or true, then they might be able to create like enough flexibility. And really at the core of ACT is psychological flexibility. Mm-hmm. So that's really kind of what we're aiming for at the end of the day. But if they're able to kind of recognize that these are just mental events, they're not truths, I don't have to live by these rules that I've kind of constructed for myself. And I value connection. I value relationships. That's important for me. That can help people to put themselves in situations that might be a bit anxiety provoking, like maybe a happy hour or something like that, in the service of their values, connecting with people. And some of the other processes that use mindfulness can help people to make room for those difficult emotions that show up. Like if they're interacting with somebody socially and feeling a bit anxious or feeling, you know, if they're noticing that those thoughts are showing up in the interaction even, that, you know, nobody likes me, yeah, and help them.
So let's say I decided to come into you because I wanted to, this ACT therapy sounded mm-hmm. really, you know, interesting to me. And so I come in and I say, you know, my main issue is social mm-hmm. anxiety. Mm-hmm. I avoid things. Mm-hmm. This is not the life I want to be living. Mm-hmm. What would the first step be?
Yeah. Well, it really depends on like the person, but we might do some exploration around like what kind of life you do want to be living, mm-hmm. right? Because ACT is all about creating the life that you want for yourself, a life that you value, a life that's meaningful and purposeful to you. And so if you say, you know, I want a life that includes friends, or maybe I want like a romantic partner, right? We can look at kind of the ways in which the anxiety is getting in the way, if that's what's happening, and find ways of working through that, right? So sometimes people think, well, I need to get rid of my anxiety and then I can have the life that I want. But that's probably not really going to happen. And so it's about teaching them skills, life diffusion, like acceptance, that help them kind of make room for the anxiety. And instead of seeing the anxiety as like a problem and something that they need to either get rid of, or change or stop, something that they can work with as they move towards building the life that they want for themselves.
Got it. So that's the acceptance part of mm-hmm. it, right?
Yeah.
But if you're so anxious mm-hmm. and that anxiety keeps, so I see how you could, I mean, I think especially when you start therapy, you kind of set goals for yourself mm-hmm. with your therapist so you know what you're working towards,
yeah.
right? But let's say, I mean, especially maybe just someone first coming in, I mean, maybe the first session or so, it's more about defining what your goals are, right? Mm-hmm. And, but then the idea of like, okay, so how do I move forward? I guess my question is, how do I move forward
with anxiety, mm-hmm. given the fact that the anxiety has kept me from doing that all along? Like, how do you do that? How do you accept it and mm-hmm. move forward?
Yeah. I think it's like kind of the first four processes, which are all kind of like mindfulness-based processes, right? Okay. So there's diffusion, so getting unhooked or disentangled from some of the unhelpful thoughts that you have. There's acceptance, right? So acceptance largely of emotions, painful, difficult, uncomfortable emotions, that's a part of life, that those are not gonna just kind of disappear. Present moment, which is largely about mindfulness and being aware. And then this kind of complicated process called like self as context, or sometimes it's called the observer self, recognizing that, we get kind of tied into certain roles or identities, or maybe sometimes people get very attached or fused to like a diagnosis even, like, oh, I'm a person with social anxiety, like I can't do that, or those things aren't for me. So really using those first four processes to kind of get disentangled from the role or control that like anxiety has in your life, to get freedom or that flexibility, so that anxiety doesn't have to dictate or control your life just because it shows up. So there's a real common ACT metaphor called like passengers on the bus, where the idea is basically we're kind of like a bus and we move through life and we pick up different passengers along the way. And maybe one of them is like the I'm not good enough passenger or the anxiety passenger. You're driving the bus, right? And the passengers are kind of in the back and maybe they're shouting things. Sometimes they get really loud telling you, where you should go, but they don't get to do that. You can take them along for the ride with you as you move towards the things that you want. So just because there's a passenger on the bus telling you that people don't like you, or that this is too anxiety provoking and you shouldn't do it, or you can't do it, or you should leave, or something along those lines, like you don't have to listen to that. You can make room for that with mindfulness, with acceptance, with compassion, and live your life the way that you want to in the service of your values. And then the last process, which is like committed action. So any kind of like behavioral intervention, like exposure and things like that, that we've kind of been talking about, like that's the last piece where the committed action comes into play and people make a commitment to essentially move towards discomfort. So the whole idea behind ACT is
that's exposure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that there's a lot of experiential avoidance. So people avoid physical sensations, perhaps with anxiety, emotions or thoughts, that people do a lot of different things to try to get away from these experiences.
So just to kind of make sure the listener kind of understands. So if you have social anxiety, mm-hmm. what are the kind of common types of avoidance that in those different aspects that people experience?
It could be so many different things, right? So it could be, for example, somebody goes to a party, but they rely on alcohol, right? Mm-hmm. As a way to change their internal experience, to change, you know, their physical sensations and their emotional experience or their thoughts even with substances. Or it could be just kind of like straight outright avoidance where they don't go to a friend's party or something like that because they don't know most of the people and it would just be, you know, too overwhelming for them. Yeah. Okay. So there's all kinds of ways that avoidance shows up in people's lives and really kind of, that's why ACT applies to so many different things, because in so many different, you know, disorders or things that people struggle with, it's avoidance that's underlying it, that's maintaining kind of the problem. And if you can learn to move towards that and use approach-based coping strategies as opposed to avoidance, it can be really helpful.
So in the case of someone who is basically relying on alcohol, right? Mm-hmm. So the exposure is to go to that party, but not have them rely on alcohol and kind of see what happens?
Eventually, right? And like with any kind of like exposure, you can move up stepwise, right? So you don't have to do the most difficult or uncomfortable thing right away. But ultimately, yeah, it would be, what is your experience like without alcohol? What do you notice, or what are you using alcohol to try to change or get away from? Is it intense physical sensations? Is it certain kinds of thoughts that you're trying to kind of mute or numb? You know, that's what we want to make room for with mindfulness and acceptance and compassion.
I see. Okay. And so, right. So I guess it's kind of like exposure. I mean, it's in a simple form, it's kind of meeting it head on. And there's a lot of anxiety you know, about not the unknown, right? And I think this idea of exposure is, it's not as bad as you think, right?
Kind of, or maybe it is.
Okay.
Right? Like, essentially ACT, it's like behavioral therapy plus mindfulness skills, right? And so it's not just, well, maybe it's not as bad as you think. Maybe it is really bad, but like, let's make room for that. Let's make space for that and hold that with kindness.
Oh, got it.
In the service of building the life that you want for yourself, right?
So I see that there's a kind of a more humane side of it instead of just the traditional, very rigid kind of approach sometimes of CBT.
Exactly. So like in the book, for example, in like the last chapter on committed action, when I have like an exposure hierarchy, it's always, why are you doing this? What is this in the service of? Because it's about you and your life, your one life that you have to live and what you want it to look like, what you want it to be, what's important to you. And oftentimes, you know, unfortunately, people restrict their lives because of things like anxiety. And they're not living the full life that they want. So it's really about helping people accept difficult internal experiences, like difficult emotions or thoughts that they find distressing or physical sensations that make them very anxious, or in some other way cause discomfort, to not restrict their life so that they can really live the full life that they want and what's meaningful to them.
Yeah, I also think about it is you have a difficult emotional experience and you get so wrapped up in that, right?
Yes, exactly.
Like you said, kind of that bus metaphor, it becomes the driver.
Yes.
It really should just be the passenger.
Exactly. Yep. So a lot of times, you know, after I've introduced that metaphor, I'll ask clients, like, it sounds like anxiety is driving the bus right now, right? Or are you driving the bus right now? Are you going in the direction that you want? Because that's really the idea. And you're totally right that when people don't have kind of the skills of mindfulness and acceptance to create enough distance and space from those emotions, for example, or from the thoughts related to those emotions, then they do drive the bus, or they can. But if they're able to develop those skills, then they're in control, right? Mm-hmm. Not that those experiences are necessarily going to go away. They might change, right? So even just kind of getting a little bit of distance or space from them can decrease the intensity of those experiences and create flexibility to engage in kind of like the behaviors that are meaningful to you. But it's really about you are in control of your life, and these things, these thoughts, these feelings, they don't have to drive the bus. They don't have to get in the way.
Got it. So we talked, I mean, we focused on anxiety because I think it's easy to grasp the idea of what anxiety is, how it feels. What about depression?
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about ACT in depression treatment?
Yeah, I think I'll try to use like another example, particularly maybe people who have kind of, you know, dysthymia or persistent depressive disorder, this really low grade chronic depression. A lot of times it's because there's certain ideas or beliefs, right, that maybe the person's not really recognizing as an idea, a thought, a mental event, a belief, a story, narrative, whatever you want to call it, but that there might be a lot of rigidity in their thinking about themselves in particular. A lot of negative thoughts about themselves. Again, like, people don't like me, I'm not a likable person, or nobody would ever want to be with me, right? So somebody who's maybe divorced or single and really values connection and really values partnership, but has created this way of thinking about themselves that they're not even really recognizing is just a narrative that they've constructed, and living with this thought or idea that, you know, I'm going to be alone as a rule, right? So somebody like that, again, it's using processes like diffusion to get people. And sometimes it's hard. Sometimes people are very attached to the things that are holding them back, right? So sometimes people are very attached to negative beliefs or stories that they have about themselves. And then they might try to get into kind of, you know, almost like a debate. Like, you know, if you're using the more traditional CBT model, it's like, well, this is the evidence that people don't like me, that I should be alone. And that's why ACT steers away from that, because you don't want to get entangled in those thoughts. It's really not about the evidence for or against or anything like that. sometimes that can be helpful for people, but sometimes it just, it's like quicksand and it can like just like pull people further in and keep you stuck and not help you to get anywhere. So it's really just trying to help the person recognize, you know, that this is a story, this is a narrative, it's not a fact, it's a mental framing of themselves, it's a belief that they have about themselves. And could there be, you know, another way of thinking or feeling about themselves? And even if there's not, just recognizing that it's a thought or a narrative, that it's not truth, that might help to create a little bit of flexibility in their thinking. But sometimes people use these things almost as a way to protect themselves. So sometimes it's kind of interesting, but sometimes it seems like whether it's depression or anxiety, that's the problem. It's almost like this is the way the person's coping and they've just chosen to cope in this way that's not really serving them. And maybe it doesn't really feel like a choice, but maybe helping to have them recognize that. If I believe that I don't, you know, I'll never be with anybody, nobody could ever want to be with me, that allows me to not move towards the discomfort of vulnerability, of seeking connection. It allows me to not open myself up to rejection. And maybe that's what I'm avoiding, right? So maybe we need to move towards vulnerability as we kind of diffuse from these thoughts about being unlikable or being unworthy, you know?
So if you think about, because your book talks about therapy in 7 weeks, so is this a very kind of, is this a focused, very time-limited type of therapy?
Not necessarily, right? So like, it depends on the person. It can be time-limited, right? So it's definitely something that you can do in a number of weeks, but it might not look like that for everybody, right? So one of the things that I like to tell people is, you know, like, how long have you been struggling with this, right? And if it is something that's more recent, it has less of a grip on people, it tends to be easier for people to move through it than if it's something that they've been struggling with for decades. But that's not necessarily the case. Like, somebody might be able to start to use some of these skills really well. Kind of depends on the person.
Okay. So how long do you usually, I mean, you have long-standing clients that you see and you implement this type of kind of modality, you know, consistently throughout the course of treatment with them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but it really depends on the person, right? So I've had some people with like OCD or social anxiety disorder that maybe I've seen for even less than 7 weeks, right? Sometimes people really take to this idea that, oh, like, I didn't know, like, some people really don't know that like their thoughts are not facts. Like, some people, for example, like, I had somebody come in with OCD and it was like related to sexual orientation, right? Sometimes called HOCD, where they were having thoughts about, you know, this idea or possibility that they might be gay. And it's not that they were having feelings of attraction for, you know, the same sex, like somebody that might be questioning. It's more about this idea of uncertainty and those thoughts that they might be gay or something like that. They were really distressed by that. And then just kind of introducing this quick intervention that, like, we don't control our thoughts, right? Like, people sometimes think that we control our thoughts, or that the things that we think, like, we've always intentionally generated, right? And what I like to tell people is we can shift and shape our thinking, right? It's not like it's completely out of our control, but some thoughts just pop up, and yet we might give them a lot of weight or a lot of credit. But it doesn't need to be like that. It's really, truly just like a mental event. And so even just kind of framing thoughts in that way could really help somebody with OCD, or maybe they have thoughts of like harm, right? Not because they want to harm themselves or others, but like if they, you know, walk through the kitchen and they see knives, and they have that intrusive, distressing thought about like stabbing a loved one or something like that. Understanding that they're not generating that thought. It's not necessarily that they want that. It's actually because they really value their partner and they don't want to hurt their partner, that thoughts like that sometimes show up. That can really help people, like, almost instantly, to say, oh, like, it's okay if these thoughts pop up sometimes. It doesn't mean that I'm a bad person, or that I want this, you know, or that there's something wrong with me. This is just OCD. And this is just the nature of kind of like the OCD mind.
Right. It kind of frees the person of guilt about, okay, what does this mean about who I am as a person?
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So, I mean, some people really quickly are able to use some of these skills.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of compassion for yourself. Right.
Absolutely. Right. So in the book, I talk a lot about self-compassion and just how important and how powerful that is. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
As opposed to shaming or judging yourself for the thoughts that show up or for your feelings. Right. So it's really about, again, accepting your internal experience. And sadly, you know, culturally or societally, a lot of people have learned to do the opposite of that,
right.
To judge themselves, guilt, blame, shame themselves for their thoughts, for their feelings. Kind of as a society, we're not very tolerant of like difficult, uncomfortable feelings, but that's kind of the human condition, you know,
right.
That those are a part of life in addition to some of the more pleasant ones.
Right. So kind of go in a direction, this idea that, okay, so you recognize the thoughts, you
mm-hmm.
kind of understand that, you know, they're just part of you, but
mm-hmm.
you don't necessarily have so much control over them.
Right.
And then kind of name them as just, you know, something that, you know, is just they're a passenger on the bus.
Right.
And if you acknowledge that those thoughts or feelings actually don't move you towards the goal that you want for yourself,
mm-hmm.
say, okay, it's actually not, it's not helpful for me to have them be the driver right now. Sometimes they might be helpful to be the driver.
Yeah, and actually emotions in particular, I think a lot more than thoughts. Like the mind is a really wonderful problem-solving tool, right?
Mm-hmm.
It helps us to plan and organize and all of those things. But outside of that, it might not be the tool that we need.
Right.
Right?
Right.
But emotions in particular actually contain a lot of valuable, important information about what we want and what direction that we want to go in. And so it's also about helping people to not just turn away from their emotions, but to listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is this telling me? Right. So like, you know, like if a client comes in and says, oh, I have this problem, I'm really lonely. it's like, okay, well, what is that telling us? It's not just like, let's find a way to get rid of this loneliness, you know, with video games or some other distraction. It's like, I think this is a sign that you want more connection, right? I think that's,
mm-hmm.
you know, emotions are wise. They have their own intelligence. And unfortunately, people tend to kind of over-prioritize thoughts and undervalue their emotions.
Right. So in a way, you kind of allow them to experience that emotion.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess kind of going with that loneliness
mm-hmm.
example, right? So, but let's say the loneliness is leading to depression,
mm-hmm.
right? And so in what instances would you say, let's just make that loneliness a passenger instead of, I would see that loneliness could be a motivating factor.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So how do you determine how to address that?
Well, it's like we want to make use of the emotion. So we want to make contact with the emotion. This is a good example, right? So instead of just avoiding the feelings of loneliness with video games or with some other kind of distraction, we want to decrease the avoidance of that painful feeling, make contact with it, and listen to what it's telling us, right? So if it's that there's an absence of connection in this person's life and that it's leading to depression, that we want to start to move away from avoidance and again move towards approaching the things that maybe are a bit difficult or scary for them or that might cause some anxiety, again, vulnerability, connection with people. And then maybe some of the loneliness does go away, but in a way that's healthy as opposed to something that's unhealthy and just going to maintain the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really common theme, that when people use avoidance, you know, as a way of coping with difficult emotions, that the problem just persists or worsens. But when they approach it, like approaching the loneliness as a way of using it to ultimately work towards establishing connection, then it doesn't persist.
Hmm. Okay. I was also thinking, is there a certain type of client that this would work really well for, or a certain type of client that you maybe wouldn't use this?
Yeah.
Or maybe someone who just is not that interesting in kind of exposing themselves to uncomfortable, you know, feelings or emotions. But I guess that's in general, that's probably not someone who would benefit from therapy if that's not what they're wanting to do.
Exactly, right? So, like, I'm pretty clear with people up front that, like, you know, therapy is, it's work, and it's not always easy, and it's not always pleasant. Like, you're not always going to walk out of the room feeling good sometimes, right? And actually, you know, sometimes I'll use this as an example of why approaching difficult emotions can be helpful, because people will report that experience, right? So say that they've been in therapy, you know, in kind of that supportive environment, been talking about something really painful or very difficult for them that typically in their day-to-day life they try not to think about, they try not to feel, they distract themselves from. They'll often say, like, you can even see it, like people will take a breath and their shoulders will drop, and they'll be like, I actually feel better. Like, I feel better after having talked about that. And that is kind of used as an example of, like, yeah, like when you feel these things and move towards them, as opposed to just kind of distracting yourself from or avoiding them, like, that's kind of where the healing is.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like, you know, good candidates for this type of therapy are people who are motivated, mm-hmm. who are, yes, they have some resistance to kind of push up against that, you know, mm-hmm. difficult, you know, material, but are still wanting to be, are willing to do that though.
Yeah. And it's, you know, you always work with the client and go at a pace that works for them, right? So people are not ever pushed past their limits, mm-hmm. you know? And it's done with a lot of compassion, right? In the service of helping them to create the freedom and flexibility that they need to live the life that they want for themselves. It's really about helping people get unstuck.
Right. Yeah. And how much work between sessions on their own do people mm-hmm. do?
It really depends on the client, right? So, like, maybe there are some clients that are really interested and they buy the book and they read, you know, a chapter or so, a few pages a week, or do some of the exercises. It could be a really simple assignment, right? It could be one thing that they do a week, right? Like, that often works for clients. So sometimes at the end of the session, if we're talking about committed action, maybe just identifying one thing that they can do over the next week. It could be as simple as Googling something or texting somebody, you know. It's always nice to be able to identify things that clients can do in between sessions. And it might even just be like, to when they get frustrated, to instead of judging or shaming themselves, like, validate their own emotional experience, right? Mm-hmm. It's those kinds of things that you want people to start to practice. Or it could be developing like a formal mindfulness practice, you know, that they would do every day.
Got it. Mm-hmm. All right. I'm trying to think what have we not talked about in terms of, I mean, big topics and ACT.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm having trouble thinking about, like, what we haven't touched on.
So, I mean, clearly, I mean, one question I have is, what has drawn you to this type of therapy as a specific modality to really focus on?
I think, so I was first kind of introduced to ACT when I was at Pepperdine through professors and supervisors, clinical supervisors that I had there. And then I did a lot of my training at the VA, and at the VA, they're really big on ACT. And I really just fell in love with mindfulness, and mindfulness is such a, like, a big part of ACT. So through my training at the VA, I was able to co-facilitate mindfulness-based stress reduction, and then became interested in similar programs like mindful self-compassion, and really kind of did, like, a deep dive into mindfulness and started doing silent retreats and those kinds of things. And it's liberating. I find it just, like, so much more freeing than maybe some of the more traditional approaches, which is like, it's not okay to have thoughts like this, or it's not okay to feel these things, and we need to stop or change or get rid of them or control them. That no, like, I can make room for all of my experiences, and it doesn't have to get in the way of my life at all. So I think just, like, the empowerment that comes from that, or the freedom, and like I said, I just find it really, like, liberating.
Right. Yeah, it just feels like this blend of, you you know, compassion, understanding, empathy for someone's experience.
Yeah.
But at the same time, going beyond that and saying, okay, but what's our plan?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. That's kind of the blend of mindfulness, mindfulness and compassion, and then all these kind of like behavioral approaches, right, that are a bit more traditional. So it's really kind of just like a marriage of those things.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, people in distress, kind of that balance kind of feels right.
Yeah, because if you're just asking people to engage in these really, you know, kind of challenging, like, behavioral commitments or exercises or exposure, but you're not introducing mindfulness and compassion, I don't really feel like you're giving them the tools and the support in order to do what you're asking them to do.
Right.
About how to make room for your difficult experience, hold it with compassion, and then move forward. I think that's really kind of critical before you move into anything along the lines of like committed action.
Got it. Okay. Well, I really appreciate you coming and talking to us. There's some background noise in the busy street outside. But you know, on our site, we'll also list the name of your book.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So listeners who want to learn more about it can, you know, pick up the book and get more info.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. All right. Talk to you later.